7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. We have ignition. We have liftoff. Out and about is a go. All systems are nominal. Well, good afternoon, out and abouters. It is another beautiful day here in Spokane, Washington, and you are listening to KYRS Medical Lake Spokane on 88.1 and or 92.3 FM, also streaming from KYRS.org. Now, I should have told my guests this before we get started, is I'm going to read, this is something I want to do every week, is just read a short little list of things, protests and other demonstrations that are available for you to participate in during the upcoming week. And there's nothing really new on this list, but I'll go through it. So Mondays are Mikey Mondays at 3 o'clock, Representative Michael Baumgartner's office, but actually they're meeting at the V Median on Division in front of Wendy's. So right where Ruby and Division come together at that couplet there. And on Wednesdays, there's protest at the ICE office at 411 West Cataldo. And you know where that is. Thursday's Visibility Brigade. That's always from 3:30 to 4:30 p.m. at the overhead walkways on the freeway, I-90 overpass at Sherman, Arthur, Thor, and Regal. And Saturday is, of course, the Say It Saturday. It's like a little mini No Kings thing at B.A. Clark Park at 3922 North Normandy. That's at Division and Garland. And they're always collecting donations for the food bank there. And March 28th, you put this one on your calendar for sure. That will be the next No Kings rally. Okay, got that out of the way. And I'm going to welcome my guest. Hello, Chelsea Duvall.
Hi, Maeve. How are you?
Oh, my gosh. I'm so good. How are you doing?
I'm so good. Listen to Spokane showing up. All these protests and activism. So many ways to participate in our community.
I think the big problem is people being able to keep track of what's going on.
Yeah.
And so, one way you can keep track, if people are interested, if you ever want to check it out, is Spokane Stands Up on Facebook is a group that lists everything that's going on. And then also, if you really want to really, really stay informed, Spokane Indivisible has a Substack. And on that Substack, they go through Michael Baumgartner's letters to his constituents and just goes through point by point. And it's pretty funny to see what he says and what the truth is. So anyway, and there's other things on that Substack. And my friend Sammy writes most of those, and she is an awesome writer. So
love it.
Check those out.
Yeah.
So welcome back, Chelsea.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Last time we were here, we were talking about Julius Caesar.
Yeah.
And how did that all go down?
It was good. I think, I feel like I, you know, open a show and then I go away and come back and I'm not sure if I was so present with how that one was received, but what I can say is that it was so successful in terms of the cast. Like, they were a true ensemble. I was so proud of all of the growth that some of them did. I got amazingly wonderful compliments on the actors and their growth within that production from people in the community. So,
Well, we saw it, and I have to say it was fantastic.
That's a hard one.
It was entertaining from the beginning to the end, and I just thought what you did with setting it in a women's prison was really masterful, and it worked. Sometimes those things don't work, but it worked really well, and the performances. Of course, most of my buddies were in it. So
I know, so many good humans.
I know. So it was like, oh man, they're so good. And I wish I could have done this, and I would have loved to have played with them. But
they also still keep in touch. There's a group a group text that we all have. And they still like, I love that what we did in that production is create community and that community has continued.
Yeah.
Because they are still like, they like inform each other like, hey, I have this thing coming up. I have this burlesque show. I have this other thing.
Yes.
And I love, like, it literally warms my heart because if like the minimum that I do is just creating community, that's successful to me.
Oh, absolutely. So, I mean, it's a lasting thing too.
Oh, it's so cute. It's so like amazing just to see them lift each other up and like reach out to each other.
Yeah.
Because also I think we really need that right now.
Oh my gosh. Yes. Yeah. And well, you know what we're, you and I, when we get together, we can just talk too much. So let's start out at least talking about what we're supposed to be talking about.
Oh.
Okay. POTUS, the play at Civic Theater, which opened this last weekend,
Friday
right?
the 13th.
Yeah.
Yes, it did.
Wow, cool.
Yeah, it was sold out. It was great energy. What do you want to know?
Well, why don't we tell people kind of in broad brush strokes what the play is about?
Sure. It is a contemporary farce that centers around seven women that are in orientation to an unnamed president of the United States. We don't have a single name or party designation. It's very open. And I think that's an important thing to point out because it leaves a lot of room for people, right?
Yeah.
So it's about their orientation to the president, and at the top of the play, something happens because it's a farce, right?
Right, right, yeah.
And it's just about the snowball.
The spiraling of the...
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So it's very, I would say it's very energetic and rambunctious, but the characters are still grounded in a sense of real women.
Okay.
I thought that was really important, is that like, we all know these women. We are these women. Like, let's make them as real as possible. So kind of taking a realism approach to a farce and letting the writing do the farce part and then also the physical acting part do the farce part. Because there's a lot of doors on stage. There's some chases. There's things like
that. Okay, and it's a fairly newer play, right?
I mean, very new.
Like 22 or 23 or something like that. I know.
I'm trying to remember if it was 2021 or 2022. It's by Selena Fillinger, and Civic did a stage reading of it 2 years ago, and I directed that. And now it's the full production, and it's been such a gift.
It sounds like people, from what I've heard, people are laughing pretty hard. Oh, it's pretty funny.
It's so funny. Even I laugh, and I'm not like, I'm not much of a laugher.
I'm not either.
Because I usually am thinking so hard, but this one catches me off guard.
That's
so
good.
Yeah.
That's good. So when you directed the live reading, did you, is it something that you chose to do, or was it on the schedule, or was it something already on the schedule and they said, hey, Chelsea, would you do this?
Yeah. So that was a reader's theater, part of a reader's theater programming. Mm-hmm. And I remember it also had Waiting for Godot, and it was in it, as well as Angels in America, and then POTUS. And I like all three of those plays for very different reasons.
Sure.
But I read POTUS and I was like, I feel like nobody can do this like a, you know, pent up millennial can. So I should apply for it. So you apply and then they kind of like pick you.
Okay.
And I think I put that one as my first choice. And I think maybe Godot was my second choice because I really wanted to audition for Angels in America.
What you do such a broad range of theater. What really drew you to this one that was different?
Yeah, I mean, I like contemporary work. I think contemporary work can be problematic in the best ways. I also think that contemporary work can be problematic in ways that challenge the director. A lot of writers, the way I've described this particular play is that it's like a crazy hopped up episode of Veep. Like the way that this writer wrote it was like, there's a lot of opportunities and challenges for the director that she's not solving for you at all. You're just like, oh, okay. So wait, they're in a hallway and where are these guys at? They're not in the same space. Okay. But they're somewhere else. Like, so there's a lot of writers, contemporary writers, specifically in theater, they're not, they're just writing whatever they want, and they're actually writing in a way that's more cinematic, which creates really interesting challenges for stage directors.
Oh, yeah.
Because then we have things to solve. So I was excited by that. But then I was also like, I love all female stuff. I just do. I like all female things. I don't know. Like, I guess I like them because I relate to them pretty easily.
Sure.
But I also liked this one because there are so many different types of females, and you could easily direct this in a way that it's archetypal.
Yeah.
It's so easy to do that with this play, but I felt really passionately about still anchoring it in like grounded realism and then like painting the archetypes with realism.
Okay.
So I think it was kind of like those things, and it goes fast. I like things that are fast and snappy.
Oh yeah.
And like a little bit reckless. I want something that's a little bit dangerous.
Yeah. I mean, well, that's the audience mindset,
yeah.
right?
Yeah. I like that sort of thing. I mean, I would say that was also true of Julius Caesar,
yeah,
right?
Definitely.
It was fast and dangerous in some ways. And POTUS is the same exact way.
Yeah.
Dracula was like that.
Yeah.
You know, another contemporary female writer.
Yeah.
So I guess like maybe I have a thing with contemporary female writers. I don't
know. Maybe. So that explains what drew you to it. When you're looking at this, you sort of talked about the archetypes of these characters that are involved. Are there any archetypes of like current people you would see in this current administration?
Yeah. I mean, well, I tried to really not be attached to an administration.
Yeah.
That felt very, very, and I talked to the design team about this. I was like, we're not using the political party colors blue or red. We're not doing it. We're not talking about any party. I want us to liberate ourselves from any administration.
Yeah.
Because literally, it could be the current one, or it could be, you know, Clinton, or it could be Reagan. It could be anybody.
Because I was going to, and well, that's such a smart thing to do, because I think in this administration that we have now, there are female archetypes.
Oh, yeah.
Which are, I would say, pretty new in some ways. I mean,
I think they've been around. They just haven't been on
maybe
the
global have been raised
stage.
Up like that.
There's been a lot of voices empowered since he first got in.
I mean, Kristi Noem, that's a pretty.
Yeah,
that's a pretty interesting one. I mean, it just sort of shows
but
you.
But I think she's been around. It's just that now they're empowered. They're lifted,
and they don't. There's no shame in being an evil person now.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah. I really tried to get away from any administration association, and the reason is because I don't want to demonize any of these women.
Right.
B,
yeah, because that'd be tough for people to overlook that.
Correct.
Yeah.
B, I felt it really important to validate each of these women's journey because they're all so different. They're all different. And all of them are valid. And really what they're up against is a system of oppression that's patriarchal. And it doesn't matter what color of the politics it is. It's any patriarchal system.
Yeah.
And particularly in the U.S. system.
Yeah.
So I really early on liberated myself from that. And I don't really felt like it ever, like that decision was ever the wrong one. It was always the right one because it never came up again. It just naturally went that way.
And maybe I get your intuition too on that. And I think intuition lots of times is just being paying attention and being informed, you know, and seeing things. You know, just a couple days ago, I read about a play in Germany. Did you read about this play? It was in Germany, and it was a play about fascism. And there were these characters that... new play. And they celebrate something once a year by taking a fascist home and then killing them.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I guess at the end, the person who's the fascist, I guess, who's going to die, gives a speech. But people were so, I guess they went up and started like hitting the actor or something like that.
Yeah.
They got really incensed. And part of me was like, oh, that's great theater. You know, I mean, to have people drawn in like that. And But part of it is like with this play today, I mean, it's kind of like, I can see needing the relief of being able to laugh, especially at maybe what used to be normal. And now there's this new normal that nobody wants. Mm-hmm. And so, so I think that's got to be a good release for your audience members too.
Yeah. You know, I came home from tour very tired. Right. And I basically was home for 4 days and then went into rehearsals. But I will tell you that rehearsals were such a gift. It was such a gift to be in this room with these women and Matt Pope. Yeah. He was our amazing stage manager.
Yeah, he's your stage manager.
Also, and like, I couldn't have asked for a better like male to be in the room that leaves so much space for these women to investigate this stuff that he's can't relate to and is on another side of. He was fantastic. But it was such a gift to be in this room with these women and Matt and laugh every single night. Yeah. There was never like, and I was like, ugh, maybe like this is what is. And I was like, I really think it got me through the past month and a half, honestly.
Yeah.
Well, not month and a half, but like month and a quarter. Because it saved me. Like, I just was so happy to come into rehearsals every night. Yeah. And even when some of the things that I was staging was like more challenging, or, you know, there's a scene that has the two characters of color in it, right? So I have some immediate privilege that I have to like understand how to break through and give space for those two actors to investigate that. Like, there is some tough work within this script. Even when those days were there, I was so happy to just come in.
Yeah.
And also it was really unique to just be like, yeah, we all orient ourselves to this script in some way because we're all women.
Right.
It was such a gift. I mean, listen, I mostly direct dramas, I feel like.
Yeah.
But like, this was like a breath of fresh air. Yeah. And I really feel like, I do feel like Mel Brooks says that like, comedy is humanity.
Yeah.
And we need it right now. And laughter, it can be cathartic, like the Greeks,
absolutely,
right? Expelling the emotions, right?
Yeah.
So we don't do bad things on the streets. That's what the Greeks thought. But, you know, but like, it's so needed. We need to be in the room. And there were so many like watching the audiences, because I had a lot more invited audiences to the dresses because they needed laughs, right? And just watching these audiences, these women nodding their head and wiping a tear once in a while and laughing, I was like, yeah, this is what I was made for. Like, this is what, and this is what I need to do right now.
Yeah.
So yeah. It was beautiful.
Well, that's not that, you know, we got so many more questions and we're going to delve into some other issues too, but why don't we,
go on a break?
Well, we're going to go on a break, but we got to first let people know how they can get tickets and how they can see it and when and where.
Yeah, Spokane Civic's website is so easy to navigate. The show is playing now through March 8th, I believe. Thursday, Friday, Saturday evenings at 7:30. Sundays at 2, I believe. The site is really good and easy to navigate and tells you all of that. And I would say if you want to go to this show, you need to get your tickets quickly because the shows are selling out. And what else did I want to say about this show? Oh, it flies by. Like, the first act is under an hour, and the second half is like 45 minutes.
Oh, that's
so
nice.
So it's honestly really fun.
I love that theater in this town. You can advertise and go on the radio and do all this stuff, but always it's the word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
That just drives ticket sales.
Yeah.
Which is cool because it's all about talking to each other. All right, we're going to play a little bit of music while I load up my stuff. We've got some Nick the Beat with Green Warriors doing Carrots, Clowns, and Commerce while I do this, and I'll be right back.
In a row they gather, 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 oh so tight. They think they know that they're the best and feel the slightest slight. The garden queens, the chosen. They look so clean and oh so bright and never ever soiled. Commerce takes too long, I want to see them all get boiled. They tell us all to wait, they'll turn real sweet once it gets real cold. When all of us have all been picked and some are growing mold. Carrot cake and carrot juice and carrot raisin salad. They'll hate me and my rhyme because it's not a ballad. Name's Nick the Beat, I am real neat, that is what I said. Some clowns call me beat down, but I'm Detroit dark red. Try hard, I'm a genius bard, hang with me a while. My face is scarred and likes was charred, compost me on a pile.
Support for Out and About comes from Breathing Room, an in-person workshop with Michael Mullen Skelton, March 6th through 8th at the Women's Club of Spokane. The workshop includes guided practices using conscious breath and movement. More information is available online at movements-matter.com or by phone at 509-499-3750.
Out and About receives support from Eastern Washington University, the region's polytechnic, offering an increased emphasis on real-world, hands-on learning to build career-ready skills and a lifelong community. More information at ewu.edu.
Out and About receives support from Boots Bakery and Lounge, specializing in vegan bistro fare and gluten-free baked goods. Located in the Saranac Commons, 19 West Main Street in Spokane. Open 7 a.m. through 7 p.m. Monday through Saturday, 7 a.m. through 5 p.m. Sundays. Full menu and information at bootsbakery.com.
Your radio station, KYRS, actively supports the diversity of the Spokane area, celebrating the many voices that make up our region. Our volunteer-run station hosts a variety of shows that feature otherwise unheard perspectives and opinions. In a sense, KYRS is working against institutional racism, sexism, homophobia, and other forms of oppression simply by existing in opposition to mainstream media. Please make a pledge today by texting Give KYRS to the number 44321. Your support keeps KYRS operating during a time when our community needs free and open media the most.
The National Alliance on Mental Illness is hosting one-hour suicide prevention courses every first Wednesday of the month at 6:30 p.m. Trainings are held at the NAMI office at 152 South Jefferson. This event is open to the public. More information can be found at namispokane.org.
Yep. Thank you. I've got somebody operating my board for me today. That's really nice. Hi, Chelsea. Welcome back.
Thanks.
And I'm talking with my friend Chelsea DeVault, who's the director of POTUS. And there's a little more to the title of POTUS, kind of a subtitle to it. Yeah. But we can't say it because of FCC rules. I mean, we can say part of it.
We can say behind every dumb male is our seven women trying to keep him alive.
Yeah, there you go.
We can say that. So it's POTUS or behind every dumb
and,
male.
And be dumb blank.
Dumb male.
Blank, yeah.
Our seven women trying to keep him alive. Yeah.
So, you know, if you go to this play and you add that on when you tell people, they're going to think you're a little more intellectual because you have this subtopic to it, too. Well, so I was going to ask you, when you're talking a lot about, just before we left for the break, was you were talking a lot about how good it was to be in this room with women rehearsing and making you really happy. And I was going to ask you, when you aren't doing, which is not that frequent, but there are times when you aren't directing or acting or writing. Well, actually, let's say writing out. Let's just say acting or directing. Because my question is, do you find yourself having to find a way to make connections with people on your off time? Or do you take this off time and just sort of like recharge your batteries and then you're grateful to be with a group of people again?
I mean, I definitely am probably more introverted. So I definitely recharge more. But I try to like make time for people that really matter to me. Like for instance, I am very close with Dawn Taylor Reinhardt.
Oh yeah. Uh-huh.
And I haven't seen her, like we haven't spent time together since I got back, cause she was in Emma and then I was directing
Puddick. Yeah, that's right.
So I try to make time for people. Also, I think, last fall, my dad had heart surgery,
okay,
which was really crazy. It was kind of like the first sort of like, oh yeah, my dad is mortal, you know, uh-huh, that sort of thing. And I was like, yeah, life is precious and short. So I'm trying to like restore my tank and spend more time with people.
Yeah.
I mean, right now I'm just in a kind of a weird transitionary phase because I just finished POTUS and I don't really have any more contracts until the summer.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I'm kind of with you in that, and that I kind of like to, especially like writing, you know, like I like to write. Yeah. And do things in graphic and art and paint and stuff. And so they're really solitary pursuits and I don't mind being by myself.
I don't either.
I find that like before COVID, my wife and I were talking about this. We would have people over like at least once a week for mm-hmm. dinner. You know, we just wasn't like, you know, big deal. People would just come over and we'd have dinner. And then after COVID that, you know, kind of ended.
Dropped off.
Yeah. And we just had friends over the other night who always have us over. And when they left, we said to each other, man, that was so much fun. I forgot how much fun that is. And so, yeah, there is that kind of, I think you kind of just get used to your situation, you know?
Yeah, I think everybody kind of went through that transition with COVID. I mean, I also do okay by myself. Like, I can be very solitary. But I do like go and see, I have family in town. So I go see them, like hang out with them.
Yeah.
It's funny, we have a lot of the same solitary pursuits because I also paint and write. So,
yeah. I think that's not uncommon for people who to be involved in all these. I think these are kind of I don't know.
Maybe.
What would you, if you had to do one thing couldn't do anything else, what would you do?
For the rest of my life?
Yeah. Let's out of writing, out of directing, out of acting, you could still eat. You could still breathe and go to the bathroom. You go to the bathroom. But but you have to pick like painting, writing, directing, acting.
Oh, I don't know. I think I'm really bad at these kind of questions because I am so multidimensional, mm-hmm. like all the time. And all the women in my family are kind of like that on my mom's side. It's really odd. All of us are like multi-career, multi-like. Right. I don't know if I would pick one. If I had to do just one, maybe I would like divert and do something totally different. Like,
oh, that's a good answer.
Like go into something that wasn't so singular in a role. I mean, I really love teaching. I do love teaching. And I think that's a part of my directing naturally is I try to teach. And one of the actors in POTUS was actually like, you're a really good teacher. I was like, that's the highest compliment I think you could give me. I really appreciate that.
Yeah. So. And you were doing that for such a long time down in Utah State University Eastern, right?
And then here with Gonzaga, I was adjunct for a while and Whitworth for a little bit. Now I'm just kind of like waiting for contracts. I don't know what's going to happen.
Right. Right. Well, you know, So you're the Utah State thing is done.
Oh yeah. Well, because that was legislative, right? That program that I taught at is no longer in existence.
Yeah.
After this year, it's going to be gone. So like I could have stayed there this year.
Yeah.
But I was like, no, I'm going home. I wanted to be in the Northwest. And actually it's really interesting because I was doing a job application today for something. And it had a really great DEI sort of questionnaire that you had to fill out. And on that questionnaire, I was talking about like how when I was in Utah, I was really made aware of the privileges of living in Washington for specifically for trans community and queer communities. And I think we talked about this when I got back. So, I could have stayed there this year. I could have. But
yeah.
they were offering this voluntary incentivized separation, and I took it because I knew that even if I stayed this year, my job would be gone.
Right.
Yeah.
And did you kind of like still follow what's going on down there at all?
I keep in touch with loosely with the head of the program and the dean. And then I have a couple of faculty friends that I kind of keep in touch with. But I mean, it's just being phased out.
Yeah.
So it's really, and by the way, like theater wasn't the only one. They like cut off like deaf studies majors and like all sorts of things, environmental stuff. Yeah, it's all very dangerous. So it's crazy. Yeah. It's nuts. And it's a privilege to be back in Washington where we are able to make our art and exist.
Yeah. It's funny. I just think it's so funny. The woke stuff. I'm looking forward to a time when woke will be seen as a positive thing. Who would have thought that being awake would be a negative thing? I wonder if you had like a study, in a college for like narcolepsy, if it wouldn't get canceled because it would be maybe it would get canceled.
I think I associate.
Because it'd be anti-woke. Would it be anti-woke? A narcolepsy? I don't know.
I associate, no, it wouldn't, because you're not woke. You're not falling woke. Asleep. You're falling narcoleptic. Asleep.
So they'd be like pro-narcolepsy if you taught that
it's
that
it's a
way.
Narcoleptic society.
Narcoleptic. Okay.
I think like, but I also associate the term with woke more as neoliberalism, which for me is more in the middle. So I feel like that one hasn't been in my like vernacular for a little while because I just was like, I don't know.
Well, there was something kind of disingenuous when it first started popping up. Like, during Trump's first term, like, I've been asleep, but now I'm woke and I'm not going to.
Yeah.
Which is like,
well, and it was weaponized.
Okay, you know, I don't. Maybe the way. I think it really makes people angry, or maybe they might feel guilty because, you were called to action to stand against. Something that's really rotten that morally I should be called to action to, but I'm either afraid or I'm scared or I just don't have the time or whatever. And so you're making me feel bad.
I'm fragile. Yeah. I think it's just, it was weaponized for a little while. I think in both directions too. Yeah. You know what I mean? And I think for me, I think it went out of my vernacular because even if I'm talking to someone that I know has, you know, beliefs completely opposite of mine, for me, it's still important that I hear them and they hear me.
Okay.
But if I, like, am using and framing my language and my communication in a way that, like, shuts them off, then I feel like it's not effective, right? Like, we have to be present with each other. Like, even if we don't want to, right? Like, it's important because how are we going to, I don't know, like, how do you make people listen, right? But how do you create space and communicate in a way that lets you be heard?
Yeah. Or what do you do to make people want to listen to you? Yeah. I mean, well, I guess that's part of being a storyteller and being a playwright, right? I mean,
definitely. And some of the storytelling in POTUS, like, I mean, it is in your face. Like some people, I would, you know, how are they going to receive it? But, you know, like I said, like at the top, like I really wanted to emphasize creating fully dimensional, realized characters so that there are many roads in.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there's like moment at the end, towards the end of the play that I think really surprises people that are in it. And the way the playwright wrote it, I was like, this is problematic. I was like, I don't know, it not in a good way, because I think problematic things are great.
Oh, yeah.
But I was like, this is not the way, like, I think we need to adjust this because I think it could be more effective. And the two actors that were in it with me, they really went there. And I think what we created was something that's very surprising, very grounded, and very intimate and touching.
Oh, I'm intrigued.
Yeah, you'll know it when you see it. You're like, oh, this is what she's talking
about. And like, I went, you know, just kind of reading a synopsis of the script, it sounded like it did kind of remind me of an episode of Veep.
Oh, totally. You know? Yeah, but like, the thing is that I was always looking for is like, if the language of a play or the language of a story is just bang, 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 right?
Yeah.
When do they stop listening, right? So that was something I talked to my actors a lot about. If we're just yelling and frustrated all the time from the get at 10, eventually people will start listening. Yeah. So there were a lot of conversations.
Just for their safety.
Yeah. There were a lot of conversations with these actors about how is your character heard? How does your character allow people to hear them? You know, and that's all tactical. That's like playwriting crap. But like,
yeah.
But it's a real thing. And it's even more of a thing when you have a all female cast, female writer, female director. We already know that when we go in, there are some rooms that we go into that it is going, we are going to have to work harder to be heard,
yeah,
period.
Right.
So that was like a real present sort of discussion frequently.
That's intriguing. I'm interested to see that. I, you know, one thing you kind of like, we always talk about theater and how people should go to theater because you're in the middle of something. You're not watching it. You're almost like a participant because these people are right in front of you doing it. And also there's that element of danger where, you could trip over something. You could forget your line. There's all sorts of that you're never going to see on TV. It makes it very human. But lately, I think there's a real, another element drawn into this of the whole AI thing, which really raises up, you know, I mean, television right now, it's television. There's actors doing the job. Yeah. They're doing the thing. But in a way, it's a step towards AI. You know what I mean? It's not happening now. It's a recorded thing. And pretty soon, we're going to just have things created.
AI.
And they will be cinematic things.
There's like, are you on TikTok at all?
To what?
Are you on TikTok at all?
I do have a TikTok account, but I don't use it too much.
I definitely fell into it like during tour because there's a lot of time on the bus, you know.
Yeah.
Mostly I slept on the bus.
Yeah.
But because I'm, you know, older.
Yeah.
And perimenopausal, so I was like, good night.
Yeah.
But TikTok was really nice when I wasn't playing my Switch. But the thing that's really interesting is like there are these like AI things on TikTok, like there'll be like videos and they're completely AI generated. And I don't know how to tell all the time.
No.
And I'm like, and it makes me feel a little crazy because I'm someone like the whole reason I went into theater versus television or movies or film, because I could have gone that route. Like CalArts, that's where I went to grad school. That is like where Don Cheadle and, you know, all Cecily Strong and all these amazing film and TV actors, like it has such a I don't want to say a direct path, but a more, the path to film and TV is more easy from an institution like that.
Yeah.
But the reason I stay with live theater is because I want that real tangible, dangerous connection, right?
Yeah.
I want to see like, that, yeah, like somebody forgets a line, or yeah, see the women in the crowd laughing or wiping a tear away. And so when I'm like, I'm a little freaked out, I think, by AI in some regards, because I'm like, sometimes I can totally tell the difference and sometimes I cannot. And I'm like, oh no, we're all part of the matrix.
Yeah, who knows? Yeah. You know, and the thing is, you know, I think, you know, we were kind of talking a little bit about, right before we came back, a little bit about the shadow side of having bad things. And I would say like the Trump presidency, a bad thing.
Oh, right.
How, you know, like folks who were in the Communist Party were out marching at Martin Luther King parade,
yeah,
and they had their flags and no one was giving them any grief. And I thought, if it wasn't for Donald Trump, who's like the, anti-communist, anti-socialist, that people start saying, you know, if you're anti that, I want to be anti what you are. Let's learn a little bit more about communism or socialism, which probably isn't a good reason to pick a thing. But also this, you know, the shadow side of the something good happening out of something bad. And I think that's sort of with AI. We had
Maeve, you're the only one who could draw a parallel between the Communist Party and AI.
Well, I'm going to say the AI is on the other side of that. They would be the Trump administration.
Yes, they would.
But in this thing, I started thinking about how during the North Idaho Pride Alliance, they had their Transgender Day of Remembrance, which I was fortunate enough to be their speaker. Aww. And afterwards, they had a big, like a big meal that was provided. It was a Thanksgiving meal. It was really nice. Oh. And we're sitting around a table, you know, a trans person, a gay man, a couple straight allies, and my wife was there. And so we're talking about AI. We got on this thing about AI. And it dawned on me, you know what we're doing at this table? We're having this big conversation about things. It's the opposite of AI. And this is what, maybe this is what people are going to be hungry for. Maybe this is where theater's going to be going. Maybe that the Communist Party to Donald Trump is theater to AI. You know, because I think people are going to be hungry for these real experiences, something that's real.
Well, I think so. I also think that, like, the Communist Party to any entrenched capitalist president, I should say.
But I
think the reason there's been some resurgency is because communism, socialism, is connected to revolution, and revolution is connected to change, and change is connected to progression, right?
Right.
So, like when we get so far one way, the only thing to do is act in solidarity.
Well, and also when that one way is just so on its face rotten and has no problem admitting that we're rotten. Yeah. We are just rotten. We're going to break laws and no one can stop us. Because we have this ideology that's a rotten ideology, and you know, and there's nobody who could justify what they're doing. If you give, you know, if you watch any of the testimony on Capitol Hill that's been going on and stuff, but all to say that when you paint this one extreme and you paint it with a rotten brush, I mean, you could. If they had somebody who at least had the veneer of decency, they could be doing rotten things with the veneer of decency. But they're like, we are rotten. We are rotten people doing rotten things. And we are anti this. And so people start saying, anti you? What is that? And I think that...
it's just gotten very blatant.
Yeah.
It's gotten very blatant.
Yeah. And there's no shame. And I think in order to feel shame, you have to have morality. And there's no morality. So I think that's a big part of it. But I'm just trying to bring this back around to theater and AI, that if people want to see real stuff, and I was talking to my son about that, because he's, you know, we were kind of like lamenting the AI thing. And I said, I feel kind of hopeful that I think it's going to bring salons, because it's also not just AI, but it's also social media, right?
Yeah.
That people are maybe want real conversation too.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess like, I feel like I have a lot of thoughts about social media because being a teacher, right?
Yeah.
Like, and seeing generations engagement. And I also read this thing the other night because, I was born in 1984, okay, which is a weird sort of like in between the Xers and the millennials.
Yeah.
And I remember like when millennials started to come up, I was like researching like, what is that? And I was like, I don't know, that's not really solely me, but that's also not, I'm not a Gen Xer. And like how, I guess like I'm what you call a Zillennial, like grew up completely on analog, like didn't have computer, cell phone or anything until after I was an adult.
Right.
And that this generation that was in straddled this gap. Right. But the reason I bring that up is because as someone who is more of a Zillennial and watching these students that I have now, you know, how they grew up, their proximity to social media, their proximity to technology, it is changing not only their social dynamics, but also their, it's having a major impact on math, reading, science, writing, all of this stuff. It's having impact.
Yeah.
So like, I think in general, you know, I'm hoping that what AI does is it, pushes society to be more present with the impacts of technology on developing minds, on learning minds. And theater is always going to put us in the room with other people.
Yeah.
That's the reality. It also, like, it's interesting because I'm trying to think if I didn't talk, I don't know if I talked to the cast about this or not, but I remember thinking it. There were so many things, right? When you're a director, like all you're doing is...
Oh my gosh, you have a list in your head.
The whole time. But I remember thinking to myself, oh yeah, people could walk out. Because the language in this play is so strong that I was like, oh yeah, people could just walk out. And like, you know what? If they don't want to be in that room, don't be in that room. I remember thinking, I'm not worried about that. Also, I will say, I think Civic did an amazing job with their pre-show announcement for this show. They were really like, this show contains X, Y, Z. And if you don't, like, you are warned now.
That's funny.
I thought they did a really good job with their pre-show announcement. But being present in the room with something is more unique these days. And above that also... is slowing down. Like when you go to see a show, you have to really like slow down and turn things off and just be present with that material. And that's actually pretty challenging these days. It's hard.
Oh, I bet.
But I will say that, and maybe that's why POTUS, like the material of POTUS has been so uplifting for me, because something about the comedy, something about the reality of it has just, I'm like sometimes when I would take notes, I would like, my director brain would just shut off because I was just like, this is so funny.
Well, that's good. So, that means it's engrossing. You've got, in theater too, you've got the set design, which sometimes is very imaginative. And you've got Peter Rossing.
Yes, I love Peter.
Yeah, Peter's great.
What an amazing addition to that Civic family.
Yeah, he's great.
Truly, really thoughtful, really lovely. I had Jamie Suter doing costumes. I had Jamie before on Dracula. And I remember when I met her on Dracula and she showed me her initial like images, I was like, she's so smart. And then I did the sound design because I do all the sound design.
Yeah, that's good. You got to do what you like to do, right?
Peter was great.
What are you playing on your Switch?
Oh, what am I playing on my Switch? Pokemon Legends Z to A.
Okay.
I started on tour and I saved it. I was like, I'm going to save it for on tour. And it turned out to be really great because our two Tiny Tims, because we had two kids in the show, right? Because it was Dolly Parton's Smoky Mountain Christmas
Carol.
Yeah,
so let's talk about the tour.
Oh, yeah. We can talk about the tour. But we had two Tiny Tims. They were 7 and 8. And they were like, oh, you're into Pokemon? And so in the bus, they would come and like sit next to me and like we would be on our Switches playing Pokemon. Fine. And then we also, one of the cast members was really into Pokemon Go. So we all like a bunch of us, not all of us, but a bunch of us picked it up and we're like Pokemon Go. Oh my gosh, it was so much fun. Cool. The Tiny Tims, they were just like, my gosh, I've never been in a show with children. Like, I don't think...
So what was the tour? Where did you go and what was the show?
Oh my gosh, we went so many places. It was Dolly Parton's Smoky Mountain Christmas Carol. It's a big mouthful, six words.
Yeah.
It's a show that was written by a man named Paul Couch that Dolly Parton composed all the music for. It includes some things of hers that have previously been composed and like other things that were just for the show. And it's basically, they took the Christmas Carol and they placed it in Depression era Appalachia, which is, you know, where Dolly's from.
Yeah.
And we toured, we rehearsed in New York for 2.5 weeks. Wow. And then we went to Kentucky and we opened in Kentucky and we closed in Kentucky. And we went like to the Midwest. We went all the way up to Michigan. We went to Kansas, Ohio, down to Florida, Louisiana, the whole like both Carolinas, West Virginia, Virginia. All like so many places.
Wow. And didn't she go to Dollywood then?
You know, the cast did go to Dollywood. I did not.
So what were you doing in the show? What was your deal?
Oh, I was, well, everyone in the show, it's an ensemble show. So everyone except Scrooge and Tiny Tim played multiple characters.
Okay.
So we had tracks, as we call them.
Okay.
But my track, my main character was Mrs. Cratchit.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. And then I was the understudy for the Ghost of Christmas Past.
Okay.
So... thank God she didn't have to go out.
Did you have to wear, was there a Grim Reaper type of costume for this one?
For the Ghost of Christmas Future.
Oh, that's past. I'm sorry. Yeah.
Past
is the little angel.
Yeah. In this iteration, past was kind of I don't know. Like, I guess she would like fit into, like her dress was all like quilted and it kind of fit in this very Southern trope.
Okay.
And then the Christmas present was a miner who had died from black lung. And then future was like, yeah, the sort of Grim Reaper, but it was a fiddle player. So there were no lines. They just fiddled the whole time live on stage in this crazy costume. And the fiddle player was insane. They were so good.
That sounds really cool. I love one of my favorite stories. I love stories about people mending their ways or redemption or, you know, I mean, and that's what, you know, and again, I don't want to go too back too far in our conversation, but we were talking about the woke business, you know, I mean, that right now, I don't know if we were to stay on this track that we're on as far as morality in this country, that I kind of wonder if these shows like A Christmas Carol would have any kind of meaning. People wouldn't get it. They go, wait a minute. Wait a second. You know, why would Scrooge do... Is Scrooge woke? You know, so... But I mean, I don't think that's going to be a problem because I think we're going to... I really do feel good that we're going to write ourselves.
It was well received in the places that we went. Like, they were deep south, small, rural places. We went to a lot of really rural places.
Yeah.
And we did 38 shows in 29 days.
Wow.
It was crazy.
Wow.
Yeah, it was nuts. It was amazing. But like they, I think that they received the work so well, not only because like the whole Christmas Carol thing is very timeless, right?
Right.
But also having set it in Appalachia, like in the context of their thing. So there was a whole section actually about the miners and strikes and Marley suppressing the mine. And
nice.
Yeah, so there was like a little union work, you know.
Nice, okay.
I was like, hey guys, you should watch Harlan County, USA. And of course, none of the actors were into that. I was like, come on. They were like, no, Chelsea. But I think that's the other reason that it resonated so deeply was because it was, you know, it's kind of like a little Dolly.
Boy,
love
that
song.
Is good. That is that's a good way to get people to listen.
I really want to look into like seeing if maybe Civic could do it or something, because I think it would be really.
I think I'd be lovely.
Cool. It was so pretty too. Like the production, I will say, I was a little like, it was amazing to see production value of a national tour.
Oh, yeah.
Like it snowed on stage.
Wow.
Like snowed. I was like, what?
That's
we had
so
all this
cool.
like smoke and stuff. And
neat.
And then two little Tiny Tims running around creating chaos.
Were they twins or were they just?
No, they just, when you have a show that has kids, it's often professional practice to cast two and then they rotate.
That makes sense.
Yeah. And it worked really well because we had so many shows like, every night, the last scene of the show, I went on with the Tiny Tims, and they were always so tired by the end.
Oh,
like,
I
they
bet.
Were so tired.
I can't, I'm tired by the end of a play.
But they're just
I can't imagine
so cute. They were so cute.
Well, you know, we got to, let's bring it back for one last shout out on POTUS.
POTUS!
Because we got to, that's what we're here for. We didn't get to talk about the fire horse.
The Lunar New Year.
Lunar New Year. Happy New Year, everybody.
Wear a piece of red. Don't wash your hair.
Yeah, there you go. And or astrology in general. Because
we didn't. It's a new moon.
I know. And so it's like, I feel like I've let our audience down. But we did talk about good stuff. And we're going to finish by talking about how people can go see POTUS.
Yes. Go again to, I think it's Civic Theater, SpokaneCivicTheater.com, I think. Their website has tickets. Again, they list all the performance dates and times. It's running now through March 8th, Thursday through Sunday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday at 7:30, Sunday at 2 o'clock. Runtime is, oh my goodness, with intermission, 2 hours. And all that stuff is available, tickets available on the Spokane Civic Theater's website.
Mm-hmm.
And these women are amazing. Just come and laugh. Come and breathe. That's all you're doing, really.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I'm excited. With my wife's cancer, had such a long time where we couldn't go to plays. But now we're back. We're going to be back at it.
Sarah, come see the show. You'll laugh.
She will laugh.
She will laugh so hard.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, Chelsea, so much.
Thank you, Dave.
Yeah, and Thanks, everybody, for listening. And you are listening to KYRS Medical Lake, Spokane on 88.1 and or 92.3 FM.
Except for Zorro and Batman, people who put on masks to hide their identity when going to work are rarely up to any good. And, as Americans learned decades ago, when Ku Klux Klanners covered themselves from head to toe, the bigger the mask, the greater the evil hiding behind it. Which brings us full circle to Operation Metro Surge. OMS is the muy macho PR slogan for the Republican Party's militaristic invasions of Chicago, Los Angeles, Minneapolis, and other American cities they hate. Deploying ICE and other bastions of authoritarian power, thousands of massively armed federal belligerents in full assault gear have been rampaging through peaceful neighborhoods, conducting violent and murderous mass sweeps. This is an un-American attack by America's own government on America's founding ideals of liberty and openness. The defining symbol of this government repression is that its forces are all hiding behind full-faced masks. Of course, if I was doing some of the stuff ICE commandos are doing, I'd want to cover my face too. But like the Klan, masking up the oppressors is not merely about cloaking their personal shame. It's an added ploy by the perpetrators to terrify anyone who might dare to stand up to them. As usual, though, the authoritarian powers misunderstood America and underestimated the deeply rebellious nature of our gutsy grassroots people. Some 30,000 volunteers in Minneapolis, for example, have become trained constitutional observers to police the police. And a citywide whistle brigade rushes like Paul Revere to alert neighbors when ICE agents invade their neighborhoods. This is Jim Hightower saying, their ethic of neighbors helping neighbors recognizes their power to, quote, do what's right. It's the best of America standing up to confront the worst. The Hightower Radio Lowdown is made possible by you subscribers to Jim Hightower's Lowdown on Substack. Find us at jimhightower.substack.com.
Hi, this is Teresa, and you're listening to KYRS Medical Lake Spokane, 88.1 and 92.3 FM.
KYRS Medical Lake and K222BG Dartford, 88.1 FM, 92.3 FM, Thin Air Community Radio.
The following program was pre-recorded.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
We must never surrender! America will get better and better! Keep hope alive! Keep hope alive! Keep hope alive!
The towering civil rights icon, Reverend Jesse Jackson, has died at the age of 84. We'll look at Jackson's historic life and legacy. From his close association with Martin Luther King Jr. in the 1960s to his historic presidential campaigns in the 80s to his role as a global peacemaker.
They were spending $1 trillion in Iraq on the wrong target. Overthrowing the government in Libya will begin there and begins more to restore it. $2 billion a week in Afghanistan, and yet we're laying off teachers, firemen, policemen.
We'll speak with Howard University professor Clarence Lussane and civil rights activist Larry Hamm, who served as co-chair of the Jesse Jackson presidential campaign in New Jersey in 1988 and was a Jackson delegate in 84 and 88. Plus, we hear from another Jackson delegate,